Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home, and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at ipvanish.com/audio.
Hello, welcome, and today I'm joined by Mr. Benjamin Boyce. How are you, sir?
I'm fair. How are you doing?
Yeah, not too bad at all, not too bad. Actually, even though I'm known as Bo, my first name is Benjamin, where our initials are the same, BB. And of course, I've seen that you did a thing with Carl, where Benjamins collide, so there's multiple Benjamins going on around here.
Wow.
So,
look at that. It is really all about the Benjamins.
Yeah, I mean, everything on formally, like I get in the post or anything, it's always got Benjamin on it. Lots of places I've worked has known me as Ben, I actually answer to both names sort of equally. But when BB's
come Bo thing come about?
Well, it's my middle name. Just most of my friends and family from when I was a small child always called me Bo by my middle name. But as I say, anything formal, anything official, it still comes through as Benjamin. So I answer to both.
Is Bo a shortening of a longer name?
No,
or
no,
is it just
it's
Bo?
It's just Bo, as in sort of Bo Brummel. My dad is actually an American. He's from Oregon.
That's just south of me.
All right. Are you up in Washington State then?
Yeah.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak to you because I've been a big fan of you from the beginning, really, since the Evergreen days. A pleasure to speak to you, and hopefully. I have wanted to speak to an American for a long time about either the Revolutionary War or the War of 1812. I do apologise, I'm so slightly snuffly today. And I think your energy would be really good for it because you're very, very chilled out, very relaxed. And I think that would work well.
To speak about when my country said, "Screw you, Daddy," and we parted ways. Is that the daddy issues? This is the origin of the daddy issues in America. We're still kind of internally working that out.
Well, one thing I would want to ask straight away is that you are definitely American. You're not sort of secretly Canadian or anything.
Oh no, no. There's reasons why I wouldn't mind being in Canada, but most of them have to do with my interviewees.
Right. I see. Yeah. I mean, because it would just be quite a different conversation if you were Canadian, I think.
Canadian whatsoever. Sometimes people think that of me, and I wonder what it is about my personality that gives off the Canadian vibe, but it's not that often, but sometimes.
I was just checking. I didn't think you were. I don't really get that Canadian vibe from you, but I have been informed. Go on.
You're pure British, then? Your dad is American, but...
Yeah, but my mother was English or English Welsh, so yeah, and I was born and raised in and around the Greater London area. If people don't recognize my accent, it's sort of
I was going to ask about your accent. I was listening to your YouTube channel. I'm like, where is that exactly? What is that accent speaking of?
It's like East London, Essex kind of way. It's not really considered a very nice accent, I don't think, but it's not too strong, so it could be worse.
Okay, well, yeah, you guys, there's a lot packed in that accent. It really kind of pegs you. As a certain social character, right?
Yeah, a bit. Yeah, definitely. Not people that are landed and extremely wealthy don't have my accent very often.
Oh, okay.
Whatever. Put it that way. It's maybe a polite way of putting it, but I thought we could talk about this because most people don't know a great deal about the War of 1812. It's sort of, I don't know if you're a fan of Dan Carling at all, The historian Dan Carlin does a podcast, Hardcore History.
I don't know him.
He's one of the sort of, well, the biggest sort of history podcaster. And he's done one or two podcasts where it's a topic that no one really knows about, including me, who's a massive history nerd. And I always find those really interesting because you're learning something new, you know, genuinely for the first time. You're not sort of going over the same old thing that mm-hmm. everyone knows about, sort of World War II things, but something entirely fresh. Yeah, yeah. So hopefully maybe I can bring that to some of our listeners or watchers, because most people don't know much about this war.
Well, before we dive into that, I was thinking about history, and we end up using history as kind of a shorthand, kind of a metaphorical trope in order to tell a story about what we're trying to talk about in current climate. And you wrote an article in February about crossing the Rubicon and bringing up that, summoning that metaphor, crossing the Rubicon, and you kind of give the history of what that means, but you complicate that by saying that it's, you know, the tyranny within Rome did not start with Caesar. There was things that happened before that and after that. But we also, like you brought up with World War II, we talk about the Reichstag fire. Like, you know, we summon these things to try to evoke a lens of viewing our present. But it's always politically charged when we do that. And it's never exactly accurate. So with that in mind, what is the use of history for you? What do you end up using history in order to grapple with the meaning of current events? What is the proper way to do that? What's the subtle way to do that? And how do you end up doing that?
Well, I think your question there is maybe deeper than I've got an answer for. I just love stories.
Okay.
I just love stories. Yeah. I've always loved history since the smallest child. I remember being taken to the British Museum and various castles and ruins, some of my earliest memories. And I've just always loved the stories. One of the things is, especially for this story, the War of 1812, is that it's not really glorious for either America or Britain. It's actually quite embarrassing for both parties. But I think it's funny you should mention the way we use it as a political tool for the present. One of the angles I wanted to sort of talk about, or maybe mention before we start, about the War of 1812 is that history doesn't always, I believe, doesn't always have to be fantastically serious. You can look back at it sort of with sort of a wry smile on your face, you know. I think if the British and the English and the Germans and the French are sort of maybe cousins, I feel like the Americans and the British are really brothers. And so when we have wars with each other, or had wars with each other, it's sort of like, I don't know, sort of a brothers exchanging blows at Christmas or at a wedding. Like
there's a sense of infighting a lot.
Yeah, and it's sort of embarrassing, but you can, years later, you can sort of look back and laugh about it almost. And I think maybe the War of 1812 is sort of one of those. I mean, that's one of the ways you could look at it, I think, because some people take history so very, very seriously that when they were beaten here or there, that they still feel somehow hurt immediately by that. Okay. Or they take a lot of glory from the wins and they still feel bad about the losses. I don't think that's a very helpful way of looking at history. It's just stories. You or I weren't there. We had nothing to do with it. You know, so, you know, you don't have to be that serious about it.
Well, what about 1812 do you think makes it not very well known? What is it about the kind of the events or the series of events that make it something that we don't really feature that much in our current discourse?
I think because it is quite embarrassing, neither side wins. I think people are used to wars. When you look back at, say, for example, World War II, there was a very, very, very definite winner to that, you know. And actually, when you look back through the sweep of history, that's relatively rare. Wars, you know, seldom really end that decisively. You could have all sorts of shades of grey of how they end, whether one side sort of beaten in the field but actually wins on paper or vice versa, or where there's some sort of kind of embarrassment for both sides and you have to have some sort of weird treaty which neither side's happy with and neither get their war goals. And The War of 1812 is one of those. It's sort of a scrap between brothers or between cousins. Both sides are sort of embarrassed by it. Neither win. You know, you can't really say either win. I mean, we could talk about that in detail. Different historians argue over who won, who lost, whether it was a draw, all that kind of thing.
Well, if we're talking about winning, then we have to understand the conditions. What is the war about? Mm-hmm. You have to decide that before you can understand, you know, if there's a conclusionary conclusion.
Right. I mean, even that about the War of 1812 is argued about. People argue about what the sort of war aims were on both sides. I mean, we can jump straight into that. From the American side, they talk about impressments. You know about naval impressments, press gangs?
So this is back when military activity was very strong by both the British and the Americans. And there was a lot of naval activity in the Atlantic. And right. So this is Britain at this time is still at the height of its world empire. And that's all through shipping. Right. Is that the context?
Well, Britain ruled the waves. We have the biggest navy in the world easily. To put it in some perspective, most people that are history nerds probably know the year 1812 as the year when Napoleon marched on Moscow. So it's in the middle, or well, actually not in the middle, it's at the tail end of the Napoleonic Wars, which you can describe, I think, fairly accurately as a world war, a type of world war that lasted for 20 years, multiple coalitions against Napoleon, and just very broad strokes of the brush here, Napoleon controlled the continental Europe, he controlled the land, and Britain ruled the waves, controlled the sea, and we were essentially blockading the whole of Europe. Now, our war against Napoleon did rely heavily, strategically in the grand sense, on having a giant, all-powerful navy. And part of that was that it swelled to even bigger than it might have been, or even bigger than it would have been, to the point where we had like 1,000 ships. Had like 100 or a couple of hundred first-rate ship of the lines, the biggest ships of the time. So that's giant. That's a huge navy. And, of course, that would have cost a fantastic amount and needed tens of thousands of men at any given moment to be sailors in the Royal Navy. So much so that we decided we had a thing called Orders in Council, where the Royal Navy had Orders in Council. And part of that was that we would impress any sailors that we thought we needed into the Royal Navy. You basically take them against their will. And a lot of the people in the Royal Navy, or men that were merchant navy guys, it was better, it was much, much better in that period to be American, to claim that you're American. It was just a better deal for quite a few different reasons, money and conditions and having to go into battle potentially. So we had a lot of our merchant sailors or even actual members of the Royal Navy had gone over to America and just decided to be American. Citizenship was a lot more fluid back then. And so where Britain was the most powerful country in the world, really, at that point, and America was really a second-rate power, certainly in the naval sense. The Royal Navy really bullied its way up and down the East Coast and the Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And whenever we would find a ship, we would board it and see if there were any Englishmen on board that we could impress into the Royal Navy. Now, the degree to which that went on, the number of men this actually happened to, is up for debate. Some say it's not very many at all, and some say it's thousands and thousands of guys. Either way, it's a slap in the face to America. It really is. I mean, there's no way to deny that. It's taking the Mickey really out of the Americans. It's, you know, it's not on really. And America had since the days of Jefferson had been very angry about this and had formally asked the Crown repeatedly to stop doing it. But because we were at war with Napoleon, it was kind of a matter of life and death. It was kind of sort of all important, or at least politically, some could make the argument. People did make the argument. Lord Liverpool or Castlereagh, the Foreign Secretary, would say, no, our nation depends on this impressment, on these orders in council. So, no, we're not going to stop it. You're just going to have to put up with it. So in the end,
and how did how were they able to tell what a British person was? Did they just listen to the accent? Was that the marker when they board a ship? How do they know?
Yeah, it's very unclear, and that's part of the problem. Some said, yeah. You know, I'm an American. I was born in Delaware or whatever. How dare you enslave me into the Royal Navy? Quite often it was by accent. Sometimes it was quite often by tattoos. But whatever it was, it wasn't really written in stone. It wasn't really very well defined at all. That's part of the problem.
And when you're impressed, let's just say I'm an American, but I have a British tattoo or something. All of a sudden, I'm doing my jib work, and then the British board, and then they take me. They impress me. What is my conditions at that point? Do I expect some sort of severance pay when it's over? Is there a pension? Is there pay? Or is it just I'm now enslaved? When you say enslaved, am I really enslaved? I have no rights until they dispense with me or canon does.
No, not that. When I say enslaved, I don't mean in sort of in the truest sense. I mean that you're taking against your will. But no, I mean, you had all sorts of rights as a member of the Royal Navy. I mean, you were given all sorts of rations and lots of rum and pay. So, no, it's not a true enslavement in sort of the like cotton-picking South sense. Of course, all through the ages, there's all sorts of degrees of severity of enslavement. I mean, in ancient Rome, for example, slavery was quite different to the American South. I mean, you could be emancipated. Freedmen, people that had been freed from being a slave, could quite often go on to have gigantic fortunes or estates. So there's all sorts of different types of slavery throughout the ages. But the Orders in Council was one of the things that sort of formally, James Madison, the president at the time, who's a very small, introverted, intellectual man. I'm a big fan of him, actually. Not really a strong George Washington type. He had decided that, because America did declare war on Britain in 1812, that it wasn't the other way around. They declared war. They said, we've had enough of this. And you can only imagine that at the time, it's somewhere between very ballsy and completely insane. On paper.
Really? Okay.
Well, because
Britain is the asymmetry of power.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The 13 states, or rather 15 states as it was at the time, 15 colonies at the time. On paper, it was not going to be any kind of contest. They did declare war because there was a very, very strong hawkish faction in Congress at the time. In 1810, there was a new Congress, and there was a new sort of wave of politicians that hadn't been in Congress before, hadn't really known the Revolutionary War, younger guys, hadn't really known war, and they were very hawkish. And they decided, they convinced James Madison to sort of suggest war to the Congress. Or he had a war letter, literally, I think that's what it's called. Oh, a war message. Madison reads his war message to Congress and ends it by basically saying, Congress may wish to consider what to do next. In other words, you know, let's go to war. And he won the vote on that. Okay. Apparently, it was relatively close, but he won the vote on that. So America declares war on Great Britain. Now, Britain is at a very, very low ebb. I mean, a very low ebb. Napoleon in that year is far from defeated. We know that quite soon the Grand Armée is turned back from Moscow, and that's the beginning of the end for him. But in the spring of 1812, Britain's in quite a tough spot. Napoleon's still riding high. Our Prime Minister, Spencer Perceval, had just been assassinated, just been murdered. So we were at a relatively low ebb, and some in Britain at the time viewed it that America was stabbing us in the back to some degree. Mm-hmm. There's an element of that to it, that they realised that they could maybe take advantage of our weak position. Because there's a bit more going on, actually. There is the sort of global strategic position to think about. I mean, we say it's a war between Britain and America, but it's much more complicated than that. It's really more like a four-way war. The Canadians are a big part of this, huge part. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're the only faction, if you like, the only nation that, they weren't entirely their own nation at that point, but they're the only ones that come out of this not really embarrassed or humiliated or defeated. If there's anyone that actually remembers the War of 1812 fondly, it's the Canadians. But then there's also...
The Canadians, they're still subjects to the crown, but they have some measure of autonomy.
Absolutely, that's exactly right. There were two
and
colonies.
Are they
upper
looking
and lower
February? Sorry, go on. And is the Canadian U.S. relation in a good place at that point, or is it kind of touchy?
Nope. America, <No. laughs> the United States always had designs on Canada. They always wanted Canada. In fact, just a few years before, Jefferson had famously said. So famously that I can't recall it off the top of my head. Jefferson had said that to successfully invade and annex Canada, the British colonies of Upper and Lower Canada would be, quote, a mere matter of marching.
Okay.
That's a fairly famous quote of Jefferson. In other words, it would be a cakewalk. It'd be a pushover. All we have to do is actually just march up there and that's the end of that. Well, the War of 1812 proves that particular statement to be completely wrong. But we'll get into it in a bit. Another one, one of the big ones is the Native Americans, largely under more of a federation of different tribes, certainly in the north, in the Canadian theatre, under Tecumseh. Do you know much about the life and career of Tecumseh as an American? Is that not sort of taught in your schools when you're a child or anything?
No, unfortunately, no.
Okay. Anyway, we'll get into him a bit as we go on.
Please.
But there's also, as I say, the French and the Spanish are also involved. I mean, Florida is a Spanish holding at this point still. And the French, as you can imagine, it's just a world war. They're still involved. So the Louisiana Purchase is an important part of this that sometimes gets skated over. In the age of Jefferson, which is only one president before Madison, he had famously bought a fantastically large amount of land, the Louisiana Purchase. If you look at it on a map, it's ridiculous. Millions and millions and millions of square miles. Square miles, would it be? No, it couldn't be. Anyways.
Yeah, it could be miles or meters, whatever you want.
It's just a gigantic swathe, like almost a third or a quarter of the middle of America. That belonged to Spain. And when Napoleon took over Spain, invaded Portugal and Spain, he took it. And then he realized that he couldn't hold it. And rather than let the British just walk in, he calculated that it'd be better to sell it to Jefferson. So in a relatively short space of time, if you lived out there, you went from being a Spanish subject to a French citizen to a US citizen very quickly. So it's a funny, very interesting period or a bit of history there, the Louisiana Purchase. And from the British point of view, that's not on. That wasn't really fair. That wasn't Napoleon's to sell. In the first place, Britain apparently looked at it as though that was land that was theirs to move into at some point. And Jefferson bought stolen goods, you know? So it's a big part of the sort of British side to try and nullify that or take that back in many ways.
Well, I'm just looking at the map in my head. You have, in order for Britain to rule that, they have to go around the Americas, then. How would they possibly be able to do that and then swallow the rest of that continent? There's no...
Well, when you look at the map in 1812, you're not very far. The United States hasn't stretched that far west, has it?
Yeah.
I mean, when's the Lewis and Clark mission? Well, regardless of that, people had sort of barely really gone out to California. Not very many people had gone out to the West Coast yet. And the actual formal states don't stretch very far westward. And of course, the same goes for Canada. When you look at the upper and lower Canada, it's completely on the East Coast. So all the rest of the Americas, North American continent, really, was still up for grabs. It's not that crazy to think that Britain might have designs on all of Canada and all of Central and Western continental United States, and only the East Coast would remain the United States.
It sounds like a pipe dream, but they can think whatever they want. They're riding high anyways, but it seems like they're a naval power. I don't know how they would control that much land. I don't know, but maybe they had some sort of sketches somewhere.
Also had a very strong army. I mean, we had an army that was capable of defeating Napoleon in the Peninsular War, for example. We had a very strong army, and the United States had relatively weak army. In fact, it's during this war that the United States really start drilling regular troops properly for the first time, instead of militias or regular troops that only come out seasonally. It's really during the War of 1812 and their embarrassments at the beginning of it, where they decide, okay, we need to get serious about this, about fighting and having men under arms. Whereas the English, or the British rather, had among the best armies in the world, and large as well, you know, much, much bigger than the United States could field at that time. But again, it's because we've been fighting Napoleon for 20 odd years. So when, there's these orders in council and the impressment of men, which America was very annoyed with, and that Britain were interfering with the United States trade all along the East Coast and in the Gulf of Mexico, because we controlled the waves, we were able to sort of screw with your maritime trade massively. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's, again, it's not on. It's a slap in the face. It's treating you like a second-rate nation.
And you all are impressing our goods as well as our men.
Oh, yeah, if and when we need to. Saying. If the policy was to deny France or Europe trade and goods. So if we think, for example, a ship is going from New York over to Boulogne or something for France, yeah, we would just take that. Part of the orders in council, I mean, I've got it here, the wording is very antiquated, difficult to understand, difficult to read, let alone understand. I can read it real quick. It says, "It is hereby ordered that no vessel shall be permitted to trade from one port to another, both which ports shall belong to or be in the possession of France or her allies, or shall be so far under their control as that British vessels may not freely trade." It goes on and on and on, but it basically says that we could do more or less whatever we want on the seas, which just isn't fair. You know, it's just not fair. You know, being British, it's worth pointing out when, I'm not completely partisan. And before the War of 1812, there were incidents which sort of led up to it. I mean, one of the more famous ones, perhaps, is there's one of the more famous ships, one of the more famous US frigates, heavy frigates, was the USS Chesapeake. I don't know if you ever heard of that, the USS Chesapeake. And
this is reminding me of the Patrick O'Brien novels. There's one that's set, and he did a whole series of naval novels.
Is this Master and Commander?
Yeah, Master and Commander, yeah. And it's like 22 books long, and one of them is about 1812. And I think it brings up this boat, or the ship. Sorry.
Yes, there's the Chesapeake Leopard incident, where one of our heavy frigates, the Leopard, just sort of fired on the Chesapeake, just sort of unprovoked, just sort of sailed up to it, gave it a couple of broadsides. this is in like 1807, so a fair few years before, but it's one of the more famous instances where it's just whichever angle you want to look at it, it's just unfair. We boarded the Chesapeake and took, I think, only four guys, abducted four guys, impressed four guys from there into the Royal Navy. But it was one of those incidents that James Madison, or in a couple of years' time, and the Hawkish faction would point to that and say, you know, we can't have that anymore. We really can't have that. It's too humiliating.
So France is going around and bullying all of Europe, including Britain, and then Britain is kind of standing up against Napoleon. So they think that they're, you know, fighting the bully, but Britain's also bullying America. Then that's kind of what's going on. Everybody's just kind of exerting their power.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, I mean, we were never bullied by Napoleon. He bullied nearly everyone else, but the people that stood up to him. Well, he never successfully invaded Russia. He burnt down Moscow, but then had to leave. And at the end of it all, the Cossacks entered Paris in 1814. And we, the Brits, that stood up to Napoleon. And there was a Peninsular War in Spain, which over many, many years, where Sir Arthur Wellesley, later to become the Duke of Wellington, eventually defeated Napoleon's marshals in Spain. And in the end, in 1814, the English and the Russians, well, a grand coalition, finally defeated Napoleon and entered Paris. So us, Britain and the Russians, were the main parties that sort of refused to bow down, refused to be beaten. Certainly Britain was sort of going around bullying people to some degree in order to keep the whole thing going. Because one of the things, again, a fairly broad stroke of the brush here, Britain bankrolled the wars, the many wars, the many coalitions against Napoleon. Britain bankrolled all of those. I mean, we controlled a large proportion of the world's commerce. We were very rich, relatively. So we paid for it all. But as I say, to keep that going, we had to do relatively... Well, they made the calculation at the time that they thought they had to have these orders in council, which is, you know, it's draconian. Mm-hmm. It is draconian. And so, I mean, there's other instances where there's a British ship called the Macedonian, which was lost. There's another one, the USS President versus one of our ships called the Little Belt, which, again, was a US victory. Now, that's quite rare for Britain to lose three frigate engagements in a row. That's rare.
Okay.
I mean, this is one in the column for the US, where it's not embarrassing. It's kind of glorious, really. The French were never able to win three frigate engagements in a row against the Royal Navy. So that's really quite something.
Yeah.
The US didn't have a huge, certainly didn't have a very big navy, but some of the ships they did have, some of their newer heavy frigates were excellent, though. They were excellent. They were a match almost for the ship of the line. The best, the most powerful ships were first-rate ship of the line. But frigates, heavy frigates, were sort of not far off sometimes. And so, yeah, I mean, Britain, once we'd had war declared on us, just felt like we'd been stabbed in the back for some reason. Didn't really take on board that we'd been out of order, really, with these orders in council for many years previously. We just thought that... we needed to teach the Yankees a lesson for being sort of insubordinate. Again, it's very high-handed, isn't it? Very high-handed sort of attitude to have. I mean, in war, sometimes different nations get a nickname. Like in World War One, the Brits were called Tommies, and we would call the Germans Fritz. Things like this. At the time, Britain, nickname for the Americans was Jonathan. If you can believe that. So I don't know exactly where that comes from. But at the time, in the papers in London, the line was very much that we need to teach Jonathan a lesson. In fact, there is quotes of people saying we should give Jonathan a bloody good drubbing. We should smack their bottom like a naughty child drub them like a naughty spaniel to get them back in line. That was sort of how a lot of people in Britain thought about it. And of course, there's quite a lot of hubris there when you know how it all ends. It's quite a lot of hubris there. It wasn't as simple as that, or nowhere near. But that's sort of what we're dealing with. I mean, it was a tough call, a strong call, really, from James Madison, who's a very small man, physically small, very quiet, apparently, quite introverted, really into his books, very intellectual. In fact, it's him and Jefferson, who are sort of considered the sort of the main architects of the Constitution. So these are very cerebral guys. Madison's sort of quite a cerebral person. He, you know, he's not like a Washington or an Alexander or Hannibal or whatever. He's not really a martial leader. And yet, just due to politics, that is... I mean, his wife, Dolly Madison, was much more extroverted and much more gung-ho about all these things.
Okay. Could we just sketch how Madison ends up in the presidency?
Sure. I mean, he's one of the leading lights. He's been around since the Revolutionary War, the War of Independence, rather. That's what you guys call it, right? The War of Independence. The Revolutionary War. It's the same thing. So he's sort of a big player. He's always been around. So he's sort of has always been one of the leading lights. So it was sort of not quite his turn. That's, you know, quite glib to say that.
There was something about that kind of succession. Of the founding fathers.
Yeah, absolutely. After George Washington, General Washington, after his terms ended, you've got John Adams, who again is one of the key players in it all. And then Jefferson, who I would argue, I think a lot of people might argue, is you say leading lights of the founding fathers. For me, Jefferson is right up there with the most important. His political writings are among the most important. Mm-hmm. Although it was a collaborative work, I think the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution and all that sort of thing, without Jefferson, things would have looked very, very different. And Madison was just, you know, part of that clique, part of that cabal. Cabal is probably an unfair word. He was always, if he wanted that highest office, they called it, what did they call it? Like sort of the top magistrate or the senior magistrate. He was always, if he wanted to go for it, it could have been his. In other words, he had a lot of gravitas, a fantastic amount of gravitas, really. And so, yeah, when he gets in, that is what he decides to do. They've had enough of impressment. They've had enough of their trade being strangled. And also, one of the other main reasons for war, as far as the Americans are concerned, is that the British, as part of our general stratagem to screw with Jonathan, was to incite the Indian tribes, the Native American Indian tribes, to just be... to not behave themselves, really, on the frontiers. And you can imagine that Congress, or the leading politicians of the day, again, just view that as you know, it's not cricket, really. Like, it's just really, it's not fair. It's not right that they should be doing that, as far as people in the United States are concerned. So they've got multiple reasons why they would want to, you know, check Britain in some ways. And so, that's sort of what the main reasons. So, once it kicks off, we get straight into the Canadian stories. Because once it kicks off in 1812, like I say, it's a little bit of a stab in the back to some degree, a little bit of a preemptive war. Britain didn't really see it coming. And we're right in the middle, we're right near the end, but still heavily embroiled within the Napoleonic Wars in Europe. So we can't just send tens of thousands of guys over there right away. So in other words, when America declare war in 1812, they've got sort of that first summer almost free to do as they please. And what they decide to do, because it's been there, it's been sort of on their strategic map for quite a while, is to invade Canada. So that's what they do.
Okay.
They put together a large body of men and have a three-pronged attack into Canada. You're frowning here, which is interesting because I do think a lot of Americans don't know that or aren't aware of that. I think a lot of Canadians do know about it, are aware, and I think most Americans don't. All this sort of thing is just new. It'd be new to them. Is that fair to say, do you think?
I'm terribly underread in American history, which I should be more embarrassed about, but I'm only going to be so embarrassed about because I am American after all. So we march in there, and Canada, which is semi-autonomous, but still a liege to the crown. There's probably a better word for that, but what do they do? They're like, what the heck are you doing, Yanks? Or maybe they have some sort of weird name for us, like Timmy or something. I don't know.
Canada isn't, there is no actual Canada, actually, as a sovereign state as it is today. It is sort of, it does have its autonomy to some degree. There's Sir George Provost, or Provo, however you want to pronounce that, is the British governor of one of the Canadas. There's two provinces or two colonies there, Upper and Lower Canada. And though they belong to the crown, they still do now. The Queen Elizabeth, Her Majesty, is still the head of state of Canada to this day, isn't she? You still have the royal mounties, and the Queen is on their money and things. But then it was they were two colonies really of Upper and Lower Canada. But they had their autonomy to some degree. They had their own identity. In fact, lots of historians say that it's this War of 1812 which forges a Canadian identity. In a more real sense, in a lot more real sense. But Britain had kicked the French out well, not entirely, obviously, but had won decisively some big battles in Canada against the French, taking Quebec, Captain Wolfe, and the Seven Years' War. And there's lots and lots of stories, perhaps for another day. But yeah, it belonged to Britain, basically, but the Canadians had their own identity. So, and America had always coveted that land, you know, this idea of a manifest destiny, that it's the United States' destiny to control all of continental America all the way to the West Coast. Well, back then, that included Canada, all the way up to the North Pole, all of it. They thought, inevitably, this will be our land. And so part of that at that time was that let's invade Canada. And so they do. It's quite a concerted, well, it's very concerted effort. They have at first three prongs of attack. At Detroit, across the Canada, across the border at Detroit, and one at sort of Niagara, at the Niagara Falls, and a third one even further north up by the St. Lawrence River into sort of towards Montreal. And to cut the story ever so slightly short, all three fail ignominiously. Right. Now you can imagine. What a boon that is for Canadians. What an absolute win that is as far as Canadians are concerned. You know, the Americans, the Yankees, thought that it was a mere matter of marching, remember Jefferson said. And in fact, the Canadians, stroke Brits, stroke Native American Indians, turned them back. And actually, in this first year of 1812, turned them back with relative ease. I say relative, I mean, it's not as simple as that. Well, the first one at Fort Detroit, because it's not really a full city like Detroit is today. There's Fort Detroit. They invaded across there, a General Hull. The Brits, sort of, the Canadians, saw it coming and counterattacked him. And he completely lost his nerve. And ended up surrendering Fort Detroit without a shot fired. The Canadians and the British bombarded it with cannons for an afternoon, and he quite literally lost his nerve and was found sort of drinking and dribbling on himself and asking for a surrender. And was given it. And in fact, that's one of the only time. In fact, the only time I believe that an American possession was surrendered without a shot being fired in all of history. So it's really quite embarrassing from the American point of view that. And again, a great win that the Canadians sort of dine out on to this day. I think if you find a Canadian history nerd, they'll probably know all about that. One of the other ones was at Queenston Heights, which is just on the other side, the Canadian side of the Niagara. In fact, today it's a place called Niagara on the Lake. And the Americans were pushed back there as well. And the third one was probably the most embarrassing. It was the American general was called Henry Dearborn, quite often called Granny Dearborn, because he's very slow, quite old and very slow, certainly slow of thought. And his job was to march in across the border and to Montreal and to take Montreal. And it just didn't happen. None of it happened. He had to levy loads of men from New England. And the New Englanders had thriving trade with Britain. And so their heart really, really wasn't in this war. Mm. Lots of people from Washington and Baltimore and furthermore south, they were up for it. But people in New England, we'll put a map on this in post-production, but in the northern part of the eastern seaboard, their hearts really weren't in this. They were quite loyal to the crown, if anything, the British crown, if anything. So they absolutely didn't want to march towards Montreal and start killing and having battles with British soldiers. And so sort of the ill-fated Granny Dearborn's attempt to take Montreal just absolutely failed. They didn't really get anywhere near it. So that first year of America trying to invade Canada was really an abject failure.
Well, it sounds like it's showing the state of the American military at this point, the basically the disorganized or non-unified and almost, I don't want to say decrepit, but it seems like there's not a lot of very strong military leaders in the whatever this army is for the Americas right now. Maybe they're holdovers from the Revolutionary War. Is that kind of where the army is at this
point? That is exactly it, pretty much. Their most senior guys are usually, I think if not always, but certainly usually, most of these guys that I've just mentioned are sort of Revolutionary War heroes. And now they're kind of a bit too old, a bit too past it, really. And it's a whole different card game now. It's a completely different thing they're being asked to do. So Congress asked them to invade Canada in these three-pronged attack. But there's no roads, for example. There's no real roads at that point. And so it's just extremely hard going. Congress is asking them to do not an impossible task, but a very, very, very difficult task. On top of that, yeah, the actual army themselves, the men, are militia, non-professional militiamen. And the cliche is, how true it is up for debate, and historians will argue about it quite vehemently sometimes. But the cliche is that these are part-time guys, and quite a lot of their militia training is not very thorough. And when you meet up for a bit of militia training, it just descends into drinking straight away. And they're not used to marching in column or forming square or firing effective volleys or anything like that at all. So you're asking relatively bad commanders to command ill-trained troops to do a very, very difficult task.
Yeah, so, through unforged territory. No wonder. Yeah. Which is largely controlled then. That's brings to mind the Native Americans, who are probably very adept at this non-road territory. They have a lot of control, or at least are very adept at controlling that area.
Absolutely. I mean, you're in their house. You're in their back garden. This is what they do. There's a couple of examples of that. We haven't got enough time to go into details of all these different battles and things. But one of the things that the Tecumseh Confederacy, mainly the Shawnee Indians, one of the things they would quite often do is be able to sneak up on an American position. And suddenly you find that they're on top of you. And all that sort of thing. It's kind of what they do. And whenever they're given a chance, they do it effectively. Absolutely right. The Native Americans had been fighting for, well, since the 15th century, really. And in fact, historians have said, it's just simply true that once Tecumseh is ultimately defeated here, it's the last time, really. That really is the last time that the American Indians, Native, or First Nation folks, shall we say? I don't know what's the most PC way of saying it, but it's the last time under Tecumseh that they really have a genuine say in the way wars might go. After this, they're just really entirely on the back foot. Tecumseh really embodies the last truly effective war leader for them. It's why he's memorialized in many ways. I think there's the famous Civil War general Sherman, William Tecumseh Sherman. Nations will idolize or romanticize their greatest enemies, their greatest foes. I think there's statues of Tecumseh are at the U.S. Navy Academy. And so even though he was beaten, he's held in extremely high regard. I mean, perhaps how the Brits think of Napoleon, or some Brits think of Napoleon. He was kind of a worthy enemy. You might hate him. You might think that it was correct that he was beaten, but he was a worthy enemy. I think a lot of Americans who are aware of him, that's how they view Tecumseh. But getting on in the events of 1812, towards the end of 1812, there's an important naval engagement between the USS Constitution. Have you ever heard of the USS Constitution? It's
not the ship.
Quite possibly the most famous ship. It's a heavy frigate, but it's extremely heavy. In fact, it was nicknamed Old Ironsides because its wooden sides could stop cannonball, as though it were made from iron. And in fact, it still exists today. I believe, could be wrong about this, but I believe it's actually still commissioned. one of, if not the oldest, early 19th century frigate, which is actually still commissioned. It certainly still exists. You can go and visit the USS Constitution to this day, Old Ironsides. And it had an engagement with a heavy British ship, HMS Guerriere. It's one of the more famous naval engagements, the Constitution versus the Guerriere. And the Constitution won that. Pardon me. And it is considered, that is considered, again, a great American victory. So already here, you see it's a bit of a roller coaster. Sometimes you're humiliated here and there. You lose when you really shouldn't have or you didn't think you were going to. And then you win this some great victories on other sides. And so it's really quite unpredictable. You know, like when you look at a history of, say, World War One or World War Two, most people know sort of the general sweep of events. And you sort of know the way things are going. I'm thinking of maybe the war in the Pacific. You sort of know that Japan's going to be on the back foot pretty much all the time, you know? And it's just a matter of time before America wins. Well, this is much more of a ding-dong back and forth. It's much more of a roller coaster. You never really know what's going to come next. Because, as I mentioned at the beginning, both sides, I think, Britain and America, are embarrassed, really, at various points. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, Britain isn't used to losing naval engagements. We're really not used to it. And although the USS Constitution is merely a frigate, it's not a first-rate ship of the line, it's way stronger than a normal frigate. Like I say, you don't think that its size would be able to withstand sort of point-blank broadsides, and yet it does. I think at the end of that, I heard someone say, if I got this right, that there were sort of 12 cannonballs embedded in the side of the Constitution that didn't punch through. And Brits just sort of couldn't believe that. So it does deserve its moniker, Old Ironsides, I think.
Yeah.
And at this point, in the British papers, in the British media, or in the British sort of public consciousness, we were like, who are these guys? How dare they beat us at sea 3 times in a row? How dare they? What upstarts? So there's that. But as I mentioned before, the Navy, once we're able to get, really engage big parts of our Navy, it's kind of going to be tough for America. Because I think you guys had something in the order, depending on exactly when you want to count it and what ships you count, they had something in the order of 18 or 22 heavy frigates, heavy ships, ships of war. And we had like a couple of hundred, again, depends on how you want to count it. I mean, our Navy was more like 1,000 ships. So it was, as soon as we could get over there with any sort of numbers, it was going to be tough for the United States. Because the war with Napoleon is still going on, our political leadership, Spencer Percival, well, no, he's assassinated, then Lord Liverpool. It's sort of a secondary theatre of war. It's still Europe, is still the most important thing. So Britain isn't able to send over really a giant expeditionary force until 1814. So although it's called the War of 1812, a lot goes down, really, all the decisive actions go down in the year 1814. So it's probably not the most apt name to call this war, the War of 1812. We can carry on with the narrative if you like, or if you've got any sort of questions.
But Britain's also concerned with Europe, but they also have holdings in the Indian Ocean and the Pacific too. Britain's a worldwide empire, and they're going around to Africa to get all that tea and spices up there. So Britain's got concerns all over the place.
Absolutely, yeah. An empire where the sun never sets.
Yeah, exactly. And there are, I'm sure that they're mostly concerned militarily with France and Europe, but they also have a lot of holdings all over the place. So they are stretched. Probably not thin, but they are stretched, certainly.
Absolutely. No, that's absolutely the case. And it was quite a few years before this, but it was a real threat that Napoleon could invade Britain. In fact, he did assemble a big force to do exactly that. It's quite a few years before this. It's before the Battle of Trafalgar, which is like 1805. So it's quite a few years before this. But it's not completely inconceivable that at some point Napoleon could, or he certainly had designs on invading Britain, actually, our island. So it's not a massive stretch to see it as a sort of him as an existential threat, even in the year 1812. Mm-hmm. Even by then, it was like we sort of do need to be extremely vigilant. We do need to do everything in our power here to thwart Napoleon on every possible level.
Yeah.
Of course, his navy had been at the Battle of the Nile in Copenhagen and then finally in Trafalgar in 1805, had been completely, more or less completely destroyed. It was absolutely vitally important, just from a strategic point of view, that Britain remained utterly dominant on the seas. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely the case. But so even though Jonathan has sort of stabbed us in the back and had tried to invade mm-hmm. Canada while we were at a very, very low ebb, we couldn't just do something about it immediately, really. So our forces in Upper Canada and Lower Canada were sort of left to do as best they could with what they had. It's kind of glorious from the Canadian point of view that they were able to repel the Americans in that first year. But in 1813, sort of the years roll round, and the US try to take Detroit again. Bounce across the border at Detroit into Canada, and that fails again. They're repulsed, and in fact repulsed all the way down to the River Raisin, which is quite a lot further south than Detroit, and the Indians massacred quite a lot of people at the River Raisin, apparently it was a sort of a famous war cry after that to remember the River Raisin, remember how the Indians massacred us at the Raisin. So that's sort of, again, if you're a real history nerd, that's probably something some people might know from this period. But by now, even though Britain couldn't really put together a massive flotilla or expeditionary force to invade continental United States, we did just start blockading the whole of the Eastern Seaboard, really, from Delaware down to Florida. Just try and, well, we did blockade the whole Eastern Seaboard. And, that does begin to maybe cripple is an overstatement, but it does begin to hurt the American economy quite quickly. Mm-hmm. And within a year or within 18 months or so, it's really quite serious, really quite seriously crippling the economy. And Mr. Madison's war became quite unpopular quite quickly. And as I say, it was never popular in New England. The sort of popular opinion becomes part of it. But the Chesapeake comes back into the story in 1813. The USS Chesapeake I mentioned earlier. It ends up having an engagement with one of our ships, HMS Shannon. And the captain of the Shannon was one of these taskmasters who was obsessed with drilling his men in delivering broadsides. Obsessed, like constantly drilled them to be very, very efficient and very, very good at gunnery. And so when the Shannon and the Chesapeake face off, the Chesapeake is defeated, to put it mildly. It's absolutely annihilated, more or less. And there's kind of a famous episode from that where the captain of the Chesapeake, Captain James Lawrence, was supposed to shout, or did, he did shout, don't give up the ship. That's the quote. Don't give up the ship. Because that became a rallying cry for the Americans going forward. Again, if you're interested in US naval history, that would certainly be something people would know about. Don't give up the ship. He died moments later. He was killed moments later. And the ship was given up within about 11 minutes of Captain Lawrence famously crying, don't give up the ship. But nevertheless, it was, it's a symbolic thing. And it really was a battle cry for them in the rest of that war. And in fact, going forward, really, it's kind of a glorious thing, isn't it? When people die in battle, when they're sort of martyred, for want of a better word, and they do it, with their sticking their chest out, brassing it out. There's something glorious about that, I think, most people think. So there's another couple of defeats for the Americans there. But they have, if we want to put one in the column of American victories, there was in Lake Erie, because you've got the Great Lakes over there. Do you know American geography, the sort of the Great Lake
region? Yeah, I know
that.
I know.
There's sort of five Great Lakes. And one of the most important ones, or the most important one strategically, was Lake Erie. Arguably, some historians might argue that. But one of the most important ones was Lake Erie. Whoever controlled the lake could control the region to some degree, or to a large degree, really. But of course, it's a landlocked lake. You can't really get sort of our Atlantic fleet down there. So both sides have to build ships on the lake, and there's sort of a race going on between the United States and the Canadian British coalition who can build more ships on Lake Erie the quickest.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that, yeah, I'd find it fascinating.
Huge militarization and stockpiling in this landlocked Great Lake.
Yeah.
Going
yeah.
on.
Yeah. Yeah. And well, the Americans actually get a really important victory, actually, on Lake Erie in 1813. A kind of famous guy, Commodore Oliver Hazard Perry, wins some important engagements on Lake Erie. And it kind of, yeah, it's not exactly the beginning of the end. It doesn't exactly put the whole Great Lake region into the hands of the United States, but it's very important. I wouldn't call it absolutely decisive, but it's extremely important. It sort of sets the tone. It sort of gives all the impetus to the United States in that theatre. There's three great theatres, historians say. There's the Great Lake Theatre, there's sort of the Eastern Seaboard, and then there's sort of the Gulf of Mexico, which comes into it much more. I mean, there's a big battle at New Orleans, for example. One of the things I wanted to say just broadly is I think that, well, it's true to say that even though the numbers involved of actual combatants and deaths are relatively small, the theatres involved are gigantic. In one way, it's the opposite of the Western Front in World War One, where the numbers involved are gigantic, but the battlefields are very small. The entire war there is really quite confined and small, whereas the War of 1812 is the opposite. The numbers are pretty small, but it takes place over a vast, from Canada, from sort of Montreal and the St. Lawrence River, all the way down to sort of Pensacola and New Orleans, which is just vast, isn't it? That's absolutely vast. So that's really something to mention. And
this particular war is establishing a lot of identities. It's establishing how America is going to be going forward, and then it's establishing how Canada is going to be going forward, and then it's also kind of drawing a line, maybe in a sense, with what Britain can expect in the future of the Americas.
That is absolutely true. Yes, I think nearly all historians would absolutely agree that although the numbers are small, you know, really relatively small, I think, you know, 10,000-20,000 casualties total, something in that order, it sets the tone for generations. Well, it sets the tone until today in some ways. Yeah, the identity of the United States is forged in many ways. They go from an undeniably a second-rate naval power to not that. Yeah, they go from being a country which is really in the shadow of Europe in all sorts of ways. You know, Florida still belongs to Spain, for example. They've only just bought most of the Midwest off of France. They go from sort of that kind of identity, that territory, to just being the United States as we know it today, with its manifest destiny, and that it's not in anyone's shadow anymore. Yeah, I think the War of 1812 marks that. Yes.
Yeah. So with the Declaration of Independence and the founding of our country, that started the identity, but this passage through 1812 really congeals America as taking itself seriously as a power, as something with standing in the world, and kind of concretizes that identity and then establishes what we're going to do with the rest of America. The Americas.
Yeah, no, absolutely, absolutely the case. And I think also, what it does, as I say, at the beginning, where you sort of kind of humiliatingly turned back thrice on the Canadian border, and after that, you start taking the drilling of men and having a professional mm-hmm. army a lot more seriously. You know, that never stopped. stopped. And I mean, well, obviously today there's a lot has obviously happened in intervening years, world wars, to, obviously. But, you know,
it's been
America,
a busy couple centuries.
Yeah, absolutely. But of course, you know, today America, the US Navy is absolutely dominant, isn't it? Absolutely. When mm-hmm. you look at Wikipedia, you look at the numbers of aircraft carriers and all sorts of things. Well, ever since World War II, or maybe a little bit before, the United States Navy is no one can come close to it. Absolutely. It's just completely dominant. And I think maybe the first kernels of that is in the War of 1812, when they realise, you know, we really do need to take seriously having some extremely heavy frigates, something that isn't going to be an embarrassment, something where we're not just going to be rolled over, mm-hmm. you know. And I think of the War of 1812, there's quite a few individual men who come out of it that go on to be important. I mean, a couple of presidents, Andrew Jackson, William Henry Harrison, both go on to be president. They're very important figures in the War of 1812 in different mm-hmm. ways. I mean, Henry William Harrison, sort of up more north, taking on Tecumseh. There's sort of a famous meeting where it's kind of been eulogized on both sides between Tecumseh and Harrison. They didn't see eye to eye. I mean, Andrew Jackson, like Harrison, is thought of as not thought of well in terms of how they treated the natives, but they were men of their time. That, anyway, that's a whole different story. Andrew Jackson, mm-hmm. a bit more south. He's down in sort of New Orleans way. Well, actually, William Henry Harrison comes into it. At this point, there's a place called Fort Meigs, however you want to pronounce it. And the British try, and this is up near Detroit, up in that sort of Great Lake Theatre, and the where some American generals have sort of surrendered the year before ignominiously. Harrison is not going to let that happen. He's much more a man of steel. He's prepared to fight and die, and in fact, repels the Brits at Fort Meigs. And I've heard one or two historians say that is sort of the beginning of the end for British Canadian attempts to go into America and, okay. you know, take American territory off of them. Henry William Harrison really puts an end to that. And as you may know, he goes on to become president. So he really forges his reputation in this war. Mm-hmm. Also, in 1813, there's the Battle of the Thames, obviously a different River Thames to the one that runs through London. I think there's many River Thames in the world, many Londons in the world, and there's quite a few Londons in America, isn't there? But yeah, there's a Battle of the River Thames, where, again, that's a victory for the US, and they reclaimed Detroit. It was in the hands of the Canadians at that point. But it's at that point, it's around that time, around the Battle of the Thames, where Tecumseh is killed. The Brits and the Canadians retreat, decide it's a tactical retreat. And Tecumseh says, mm-hmm. We can't. I've got nowhere to run to. I've got to live or die here. You know, I've got nowhere else to go. This is my land. And some Kentucky men, some cavalry from Kentucky, ride him down and he's killed. And as you can imagine, that's, again, sort of eulogized and romanticized by various people over the ages, the death of Tecumseh. Because as I mentioned earlier, his Confederacy, the Shawnee Confederacy, was really the last serious, you know, really, really serious attempt for the Native Americans to be a power in their own right. Mm-hmm. So the death of Tecumseh mm-hmm. is sad, I suppose, depending on how you look at it, of course. And it's in 1813, towards the end of 1813, that it's kind of an important point, is that the US burned down a town that's on the other side of the Canadian border called York. They burn York to the ground, and that town of York is to modern day Toronto. Some people might not be aware that the US troops burnt Toronto to the ground in 1813, but they did. But that was one of the things where you don't really do that. You don't necessarily...
It's overstepping.
Yeah, you don't really do it. You don't really b- Melbourne, the big towns or big cities that are full of freeborn Christians necessarily. That's a little bit beyond the pale. It's not really done. Huh. But they did it. And it's, again, that kind of sets the tone. You know, when one side in a war does something that's a bit egregious, it sort of gives free rein for the other side to do the same sort of thing, doesn't it? You know, and you get a sort of a one-upmanship of who can be more cruel and sadistic. I wouldn't say it started there, certainly not. But it does set the tone for some things that happen going forward. There's a big battle, the Battle of the Horseshoe Bend. This is where Andrew, one of the points where Andrew Jackson, who later becomes president, comes into it, because he won at that battle, the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, beating a lot of Native American Indians. They were called the Red Stick Confederacy. And with the victory at Horseshoe Bend, the United States is able to extort, maybe a bit strong, but are able to have a treaty which gives them a lot of land. I mean, something on the order of 23 million acres worth of land. Basically, most of Alabama, big parts of modern-day Georgia, which are sort of all ceded to the United States after that one battle. So again, it's really quite an important one, really, for the founding of the United States as we know it. You know, if that battle had gone differently.
The sovereignty of America is forged in that.
Not their birth, but, you know, it's just a part of the story, certainly a big part of the story of the United States as we know it today. You know, if that battle, the Battle of the Horseshoe Bend, had gone differently, you know, how different history might have been, you know, how... it seems inevitable, doesn't it, that America were always going to, that the United States were always going to control all of continental North America. But, you know, if one thing here or there had gone differently, who knows? But, you know, I think the Battle of Horseshoe Bend is much more important than history often gives it credit for. You know, some of these things are almost lost to history. And it doesn't really make sense. I don't know why that's not as important as Yorktown or something, you know.
Just to back up just a tiny bit, at this point, Spain's just no longer taken seriously. It sounds like they haven't been taken seriously for quite some time. Napoleon kind of steamrolls them, but as a world power, they have kind of eroded their any sort of actual claim on any of the Americas. Is that...
Like I say, they still do control. There's a governor of Florida that's Spanish. The high watermark of their empire is long gone. I mean, long gone. They're really puppets. The two kingdoms of Spain and Portugal are ruled over by imbeciles at this point. Inbred... An inbred family, they have the mind of children. it's really quite embarrassing. the Habsburgs and Napoleon. Many years before this, good 10 years or slightly less before this, had marched sent some of his marshals down into the Iberian Peninsula, into Spain, and just annexed it.
Yeah. Okay.
So, and he allowed them to still nominally control things, nominally control their holdings in the rest of the world, like Florida, for example.
Yeah.
But it was only on paper, really. I mean.
Okay.
They are still technically still around. Again, in 1813, the US tried to invade Montreal again. But they try and go up the St. Lawrence River, but they do it so very, very slowly that, again, it's a bit like in 1812 when one or two of the commanders are sort of kind of embarrassingly inept a bit, really, to be fair. Their second attempt to, invade and take Montreal fails again. Although they do win an important engagement on Lake Ontario, at Sackett's Harbour. You may have heard of Sackett's Harbour. When the US win an important victory there. So it is a back and forth. It's not... that's why I find it interesting. When you look at it in detail, if you read or listen to an audiobook, and you don't know what's coming, it is interesting because you genuinely don't know, who's going to win this one? I think it gives a bit more excitement to it. my laptop's gone off here. By 1814, the last year of the war, more or less... it's kind of a different story by 1814, because at this point, but by spring 1814, the British and the Russians are in Paris. Napoleon is defeated, okay, for the first time, certainly. for the first of two times, he's defeated. So at that point, certainly by sort of summer 1814, Britain and the political overlords in London, in Whitehall, decide, okay, we can send a massive chunk. Napoleon is finally defeated. Let's send a massive chunk of our navy across the pond with tens of thousands of guys, you know, like 40,000 regular troops that are battle-hardened veterans from the Napoleonic Wars. Let's send them over, and we really will give Jonathan a
show
drubbing.
Show Jonathan what's up. Yeah.
Like a naughty spaniel. so that's what happens. I mean, I remember thinking when I was a kid at one point that after the Revolutionary War, or the War of Independence, what if Britain had just had the political will just to, you know, not end there after Yorktown? What if we decided to actually send over a massive army just to take America back again? Well, they did. Yeah. That's what happened. That is what happened. But it doesn't go particularly well. I mean, well, to begin with, for the year of 1814, there's the Battle of Lundy's Lane, which is, again, in the Niagara region, just on the Canadian side in Ontario. And I've heard people say that this is sort of like the War of 1812 in microcosm, because it's just really confused, and some troops start firing on each other, and a couple of generals get accidentally killed or captured in the darkness, and although the US withdraw, it's actually a tactical victory for them, or strategic victory for them, but both sides are kind of embarrassed, and it's indecisive, and things kind of end up as they started, more or less. Mm. Nobody wins. There's a bunch of blood and a bunch of embarrassment to go round on all sides, and nobody really wins. But you could say, if you really had to put money on one side or the other, you would say you'd have to chalk it down to a US victory, I think.
So when, in 1814, when Britain decides to actually take this seriously and invest in it, where do they concentrate on? Are they going to go from the north down, or are they going to just take all of, I don't know which direction we're coming from. They're just going to kind of evenly take over or go after America.
Yeah. Well, that's a very good question. And it's sort of, there's sort of a three-pronged attack. They essentially go from north to south, but kind of all at once. So yeah, they want to invade New York. They want to invade Washington. Well, actually, we'll get onto the details exactly of that. They don't mean to attack Washington straight away, but they mean to attack from Canada down into New York way. They also mean to attack New Orleans, because New Orleans is, and was, vitally important for trade, because everything that comes down the Mississippi River, and in other words, everything from sort of the interior of the United States, all can come down through the Mississippi River, and it ends up at New Orleans. So if you control, whoever controls the harbor of New Orleans, and sort of Mobile, places like this, Pensacola, whoever controls that, but particularly New Orleans itself, whoever controls that really can control the commerce, of a lot, loads of the commerce of continental United States. So it's part of our strategy, part of the British strategy to, attack all places like New York and particularly New Orleans.
Okay.
So, so that's...
Wait, where's the third prong? So kind of New York through Canada?
Yeah, come down through Canada by land. That's one.
Yeah.
By sea, New York. Sort of, so okay. Hopefully meet up kind of there. And then a third one, or if we're successful at New York, the same sort of body of men come down to New Orleans. And the Brits are very quite confident. I mean, again, hubris here. Because if you hadn't realised, there hasn't been that many really bad, humiliating defeats for the Brits. But it's coming. It's in the pipeline.
Oh, no.
I'm afraid we're running slightly short of time, so I have to maybe go through it a little bit quickly. But basically, all those things fail. It's a reversal of fortunes for all sorts of different reasons. When they came down through the invasion of New York, the Brits lose at Plattsburgh. It's near Lake Champlain and the Hudson River. the governor of Canada, Sir George Prevost, however you pronounce that, is sort of strategically defeated on the lakes, on Lake Champlain, and is forced to sort of retreat. And so he's kind of defeated at Plattsburgh. So that first prong from Canada over land is turned back by the Americans. And then the Brits do try to, or do, well, what they, well, okay. One of the things they decide is that Baltimore is a really important city, really one of the most important cities along with New York on the East Coast, far more important than Washington. Washington, D.C. is a new city. It's hardly anything. It's the capital had always been Philadelphia. But only about 10 years before this, 10, 15 years before this, they decided that Washington, D.C. was going to be the new capital. And they're going to build it up from scratch. People called it sort of just a sheep pasture, things like this. There wasn't much there. There was the White House. There was a type of Capitol building. It wasn't the Capitol building that we know now with the big dome. But there was all sorts of federal buildings there, a treasury, all sorts of things. And the White House. And we had this big flotilla under the command of an Admiral Cochrane, or Coburn, however you say it. Or there's a General Cochrane and an Admiral Cockburn and a General Ross. And anyway, this Admiral Coburn realizes that Washington, D.C. is almost entirely undefended. Well, it is pretty much undefended, more or less. I mean, it does have some defense. The Secretary of War at the time, the U.S. Secretary of War, Secretary Armstrong, didn't think that we would invade it. It's not worth it. There's nothing there. Why would the Brits, attack Washington? It's not worth it. There's nothing there. But for morale, it's kind of important. Symbolically, it's very important. Yeah, they did just decide sort of on the hoof to attack Washington, D.C. It was never in the plan. They'd never planned to do it a year ahead of time or anything. But they realised that it's sort of undefended. And so they send in, the British 85th Light Infantry, the 44th Regiment of Foot, land at Bladensburg, a place called Bladensburg near Washington, D.C. in the Chesapeake Bay. There's a thing called the Bladensburg Races, because the small amount of American troops that were there defending it ran away. I mean, you can't blame them. They were absolutely outnumbered and outgunned. But it has been called, quote, the greatest disgrace ever dealt to American arms, because the Brits marched on Washington, D.C. and burnt down the White House.
Okay.
I don't know if this is new to any of our listeners. Washington D.C. has ever been attacked and destroyed like that. It was then.
Yeah, and it was America had set that bar when they burnt Toronto down.
Exactly. That was the very next thing I was going to say. Yeah. It was like, okay, you did that. You burnt down Toronto in Canada, our Canada. So this is what you get. Kind of thing, you know. I mean, Washington D.C. is quite small. I think there's only about 8,000 people live there. And the British troops left the next day. Some of the stories are that Dolly Madison refused to leave for quite a while. She's one of the last to flee. And one of the sort of famous anecdotes is there was a very large full-scale portrait of Washington that she insisted was rescued from the White House before the British turned up. There's all sorts of these little anecdotes and stories that are eulogised over the years. Good old Dolly Madison refused to give in. The White House in Washington was razed. That's why I said at the beginning, it's kind of embarrassing. That's obviously a little bit embarrassing embarrassing for the Americans. It's embarrassing for the Brits as well. You know, we're supposed to have a special relationship. We're supposed to be brothers or cousins or whatever. We're supposed to fight side by side. And yet we sort of did that. You know, it's subsequent history, it doesn't really look good. You know, so. Yeah.
Does that change relations, that symbolic victory, or just complete annihilation at Washington? Does that cause Congress and the leadership of America's to start rethinking things? Is that when?
No, not really. No. Because, I mean, the British leave the very next day. They sort of, okay. It's like a short, sharp sucker punch almost on some level. And so James Madison's back in the White House, or the charred remains of the White House, the next day. So it's like, oh, this was a horrible, terrible blow, but it's not really, it doesn't really change war aims or anything like that.
Okay.
But one of the point, one of the reasons for going up Lake Champlain and in there is, Chesapeake Bay, and is to really get Baltimore. Baltimore was a key, like, lots and lots of commerce and industry was at Baltimore. And you really want to take Baltimore at all costs. In the British press, they were like, Baltimore's a doomed city. If we get over to the East Coast, you know what we're going to destroy first, if we can? Baltimore. Because that's going to really cripple Jonathan. But in order to take Baltimore, first they had to get past a star fort, which was at a place called Fort St. Henry. Fort McHenry. Had to get past the star fort at Fort McHenry before you could really get on the road to Baltimore. And so the Brits bombard this Fort McHenry all day and all night, expecting to, you know, sweep it aside relatively easily. But they're unable to. And it's surprising that in the morning, the flag's still there, the Star Spangled Banner is still flying over Fort McHenry. It's quite surprising that the sort of fortitude the Americans have there, or the will to survive, the will not to give up. And that is where the song, or originally the poem of the Star Spangled Banner, comes from. The bombs bursting in air. This is Fort McHenry. You know, the lyrics. So that's where that comes from, that the Brits were trying to get to Baltimore, and it never happened because Fort McHenry refused to give in, you know, against the odds, heavily against the odds, being bombarded for hours on end by a massive war flotilla. I mean, it's quite something. Francis Scott Key. But one of our really important generals, the General Ross, was killed in and around this point, the Battle of North Point. He was killed. And it's one of those instances where when the commanding officer is killed, it really changes morale for the whole army, for the whole expedition, the whole campaign. Sort of the tenor of it is changed because this one commanding officer is killed. Unfortunately, we've got to draw it to a close relatively soon. But going down into the south, the Gulf of Mexico theater, there are battles at Mobile, which is in modern Alabama, and Pensacola, which is in modern Florida, where the Brits sort of push aside American forces there. And because the real key, as I said, is New Orleans. And it's at New Orleans where Andrew Jackson, that famously becomes President Andrew Jackson, quite possibly because of this, his reputation is forged, because they stop the Brits outside New Orleans, the Battle of New Orleans. Again, completely against the odds. This is a massive embarrassment for the Brits here. That should not have happened. We got like 60, we sent sort of 60 ships, 8,000 men, under the command of Sir Edward Pakenham, who's quite a famous, important commander. There's no way that the ragtag militia of New Orleans would be able to stop them, and they did. And again, this is something which is, I think, you know, this sort of thing is what forges, is part of what forges the American character, I think. Great victories against the odds like that. Nations love to remember them, don't they? I think that's important. I mean, the US did have 5,000 men, so they're outnumbered. On paper, they're outclassed, they're outgunned. And yet, it's one of those things, sometimes you get a killing field, you know, sometimes like at Gettysburg or at the Somme, on the Battle of the Somme. Sometimes you get a killing field where a small number, relatively small number of men can mow down a vast number of men, sometimes. And it seems like something like that is what happened just outside New Orleans, where the US sharpshooters or free shooters, what today we'd call snipers, are just very good at their job. Very, very good at their job. I mean, Sir Edward Pakenham is killed there, just a US free shooter is able to just sort of take him out at range. And again, that sort of can sway, that can sort of turn the whole feel of a campaign or a particular battle or a particular engagement when the commanding officer it falls.
So the Brits lose some key leaders or some storied heroes from their other campaigns.
Absolutely, yeah. A lot of these guys are veterans of the Napoleonic Wars. I mean, Arthur Wellesley, the Duke of Wellington himself, they wanted to give him overall command of this, and he refused. he just said, I don't know really anything about America. I'm kind of exhausted a bit from Napoleon. No thanks. But yeah, they did send a lot of the leading lights over there to do it. Yeah. It was sort of like the cherry on the cake. Now we've done away with old Boney. Now we can go over across the pond to the States and teach them a lesson. And it didn't happen. I mean, we started this with talking about quite a few embarrassments with the United States up in Canada, and it ends with really quite a bad British embarrassment, you know, being turned away at Fort McHenry, and being turned away in sort of upper New York, and then being beaten outside New Orleans. I mean, it really is. Mm-hmm. It really shouldn't have happened, and yet that's that's how it went down. And finally, there's a Treaty of Ghent, and there's a lot, we have run out of time, unfortunately, but there's a lot talked about by historians about how the war ended. The Treaty of Ghent, which is in modern-day Belgium, I believe, was signed before the Battle of New Orleans even happened. because it takes a couple of months for word to get from Europe to the United States, literally a couple of months, 6 weeks, a couple of months, things can overlap. And that's what it was. The Treaty of Ghent had been signed, but the news hadn't got out to the United States yet. And so historians argue over how important, if at all, the Battle of New Orleans was. But in the end, at the very end of it all, they decide that there will be a status quo antebellum. In other words, the situation as it existed before the war began, we shall return to that.
Oh, with the inscriptions or the impressments?
So that's the thing. That's why people can argue. People can say, America won the war because, if nothing else, Britain did give up the impressments. But then British historians might say, well, but we defeated Napoleon, so we didn't need to do them anymore. You know? And unfortunately, we have run out of time, but we could really scratch the surface on that, because you could talk about just that, really. Who won and why, and to what extent they did or didn't win or draw.
Yeah.
There's honestly whole books written about that.
Well, before we wrap up, did the relations, what's the relations, the general feeling between the United States and Britain after they kind of stop fighting? Are they kind of, they just kind of go back and they kind of both shrug and forget about it? We'll just go back to things.
Or
is there kind of some simmering animosity still?
No. From the American point of view, I can't remember the exact date of the Battle of New Orleans, but they loved it. Apparently, there were only two main national holidays. One was the 5th of July, and the other one was the date which commemorates the Battle of New Orleans. It was a great, great, great victory for them. Mr. Madison could claim he won the war. He can claim he gave the all-powerful British Empire a bloody nose and sent them packing. So the Battle of New Orleans at the time was a massive, massive victory for the United States, and they absolutely loved it. And it's only really the fact that you've got the Civil War and then the World Wars that have so utterly eclipsed it. And until the Civil War, the War of 1812 was very much a big W for the United States, an absolute win.
Yeah.
And they're very proud of it, I think, quite rightly in some ways, I think. But from the British point of view, it's the whole thing's kind of embarrassing. It's kind of let's forget that happened. Let's really just talk about Napoleon for those years. That's just Napoleon. And something happened out in America, but don't worry about what. It's not a big deal.
But America gets really serious about controlling their own the Eastern Seaboard, with their navy, and say, okay, we're no longer going to be in a position where people can stop our trade and hobble us in that way.
That's it. It's totally fair to say that America before and after the War of 1812 is really quite different in character, if nothing else. I think that's fair to say. This is glib, but they're taking themselves a lot more seriously. You know, they know now. They know. They don't think. They don't hope. But they know that they're a force to be reckoned with now.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And no longer will they have their men abducted, enslaved, impressed, whatever you, however you want to say it, by the Brits. No longer, all sorts of things. No longer will they have their trade screwed with by the Brits. They'll have complete control over the Gulf. And then it
also sets up the conditions for America to kind of take over the continental Europe from the Native Americans. Say, okay, we have to take them seriously and take them out or whatever.
Yeah. Benjamin, unfortunately, we do have to bring it to an end here. There are people that need to go home. So, unfortunately,
thank you so much for your time. It was great to hang out.
Thank you. Thank you. It's all great to talk to you. Hopefully, we can do it again sometime. You've been very patient with me.
No, not at all. I'm eating it up. This is so fun. This is so fun.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Sally from finance loves fly fishing. She used to spend her weekend surrounded by receipts. Then she switched her company to Ramp. Now, spend is all under control, all in one place. Her team submits their expenses with a text, and she can close the books without all the busy work. So Sally's weekends are all her own, surrounded by fish, not receipts. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.
Did you know using your browser in incognito mode doesn't actually protect your privacy? Take back your privacy with IPVanish VPN. Just one tap and all your data, passwords, communications, browsing history, and more will be instantly protected. IPVanish makes you virtually invisible online. Use IPVanish on all your devices, anytime you go online at home and especially on public Wi-Fi. Get IPVanish now for 70% off a yearly plan with this exclusive offer at IPVanish.com/audio.